If you're familiar with this podcast, you may know that I generally relegate the particulars of a film's influence to the back half of the recording. Fantastic Voyage's distinct imprint on pop culture, however, behooves me to lead with its legacy. While far from the first work of fiction to feature shrinking people, we'll get to that later, it is the patient zero for the trope of shrinking people who are then boarding a craft and entering a human body to fix something. Just about every high-concept series whose reality is flexible enough to include fantastical science fiction has done a riff on Fantastic Voyage. Doctor Who, Captain Planet, SpongeBob SquarePants, Magic School Bus, Fairly Odd Parents, Jimmy Neutron, Angry Beavers, Dexter's Laboratory, Futurama, Muppet Babies, Family Guy, The Simpsons, Phineas and Ferb, Archer, Rick and Morty, Batman the Brave and the Bold, Teen Titans, and Teen Titans Go are among the many, many shows to do a riff on the
Rugrats?
Fantastic Voyage formula.
Did you skip Rugrats?
I knew you were going to bring up Rugrats because somebody wants the watermelon seed to grow on purpose.
Okay, good. Yes, Rugrats. Very important.
I consider it likely that the number of people who have seen Fantastic Voyage are considerably outnumbered by those who have never heard of the film but have seen several parodies. So, Fantastic Voyage is one of those things where the concept has outgrown the source. This means that there's definitely something about this movie that appeals to the human imagination, regardless of it being divorced from its time. So we're going to explore what that is over the course of this recording. My name is Ryan. This is a real deep dive. All right, full house for this one. Sylvan has already introduced themselves with their Rugrats outrage.
Rugrats is, in my opinion, the best riff on Fantastic Voyage.
Lies.
I think Cheryl's on the Magic School Bus train.
No, Muppet Babies.
Sarah was Magic School Bus, but I'm not lying about my opinion.
It's what's... Okay, fair. But Muppet Babies is the best one because it's the first one I ever saw.
All right, so Cheryl's also on this and is very much on the Muppet Babies train. Her husband Pete is here. Pete, what is your favorite riff on the Fantastic Voyage formula?
Well, I mean, I'm going to go with the classic Martin Short film, Inner Space. But I'd also like to interject that, guys, I don't think I'm prepared for this mission. I can't even change a Band-Aid.
Yeah, we'll get to that in the plot recap. All right, so this was Cheryl's pick. Cheryl, why did you go with this? Is it because you and Pete are watching, like, a lot of pre-Star Wars science fiction features at the moment?
Actually, we were watching the Poseidon Adventure on Antidana's Remembrance Day.
The remake of the Poseidon Adventure.
I love the original Poseidon Adventure, but anyway, I did not love the remake. But so then my husband was trying to get me to watch, what was that movie you just mentioned?
Inner Space.
Yeah, he was trying to get me to watch that one, so I was like, I'll watch this one instead.
All right, that's as good a reason as any.
I have to say, I was very surprised to hear about a Cheryl pick that I didn't mind being present at.
I got range. You probably like my 70s picks.
Yeah, Cheryl's trying to avoid stuff that's deliberately awful lately, I've noticed. But, my connection...
Cheryl's not avoiding nothing.
It's okay, champ.
My connection to Fantastic Voyage is that one day my biology teacher, who is presumably hungover, put this on to, you know, give himself a couple of days. And Fantastic Voyage filled that role for generations. Apparently, they were still screening this for med students in some colleges into the 1980s.
There were kelp streamers.
There were kelp streamers, but there was a lot of this movie that is more scientifically accurate than it probably needed to be, considering its concept. And, yeah, Sylvan also watched this in biology class with Mr. Glorioso.
Seventh grade science class, yeah. He was very passionate about this movie, though. He really wanted us to like it. He thought it was going to be a big treat, and we were just like... What?
It did feel old even back then, 20 years ago, but this time I wasn't sure if I was going to like it or not, but I had a good time. This is fun. Nice little throwback. And as Cheryl put it, this is a very good choice for like late night cable TV streaming. It was probably on Sci-Fi a lot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually am really happy that we rented this movie because I'm like, oh, we should buy this and add it to the collection. It was weirdly soothing for such a stressful movie.
Yeah, this is a good 2 a.m. insomnia watch just because of all the colors. But anyways, plot recap. This movie takes place in the backdrop of the United States and the Soviet Union, both having developed technology that can miniaturize matter by shrinking individual atoms. But so far, both sides can only do it for 1 hour, which basically hobbles any military applications of it, at least in this movie's universe. However, a scientist, Dr. Jan Benes, working behind the Iron Curtain, has figured out how to make the process work indefinitely. With the help of American intelligence agents, including Agent Charles Grant, he escapes to the West and arrives in New York City. But an attempted assassination leaves him comatose with a blood clot in his brain that no surgery can remove from the outside. To save his life, Grant is just sort of abducted in the middle of the night by military intelligence. And the whole time he's complaining that, like, as more information is being fed to him, the more and more he's like, I'm not qualified in any capacity whatsoever to do this.
It's like if you, like, suddenly got promoted at work because everyone else called out, and you're like, no, but I haven't been trained on this. Why am I here?
Yeah, and the reason he's here is because he doesn't know anything about shrink ray technology or surgery or anything like that, so all of the other characters can feed him exposition and therefore feed the audience exposition. And he doesn't seem to understand that's his role. Anyways, Navy pilot Captain Bill Owens, medical chief and circulatory specialist Dr. Michaels, surgeon Dr. Peter Duval, and his assistant Cora Peterson are also placed aboard a Navy submarine called the Proteus at the Combined Miniature Deterrent Forces Facilities. This is the mid-60s, so we love our acronyms. It is told to us as the CMDF.
But it's not, like, made in that order on the label at all. They, like, picked, like, arbitrarily up, down, down, up.
Yeah, it's a confusing logo. The submarine is shrunken down to about the size of a microbe and injected into Benes' body. And this is when the best acting of the movie happens, because there's just this hand guy who's just signaling with his hands the whole way through. And he doesn't get a single line in the movie, so he puts everything he has into that hand choreography.
If Ryan doesn't keep us on track, we're going to spend 20 minutes talking about this hand signal guy.
I mean, the whole time we're talking about, oh, everyone gets around in this base on, like, little tripod scooters. It's great.
It was also delightful, but I have to say, like, that man's hand acting was just as good as the traffic cops in Flashdance. Like, that's the whole time.
It made me think of The Magnificent Seven, where Steve McQueen, he has almost no lines in the movie, so he tries to make up for it by gesticulating every time he's in frame, and once that's pointed out to you, you can't not notice it anymore.
Like the snail from Adventure Time.
Anyways, the team has 60 minutes to get to and remove the clot. After this, the Proteus and its crew will begin reverting to their normal size, becoming vulnerable to Benes' immune system, and eventually it will grow to the point where they will kill Benes in a very gruesome fashion, which would violate the Hays Code. So that doesn't happen. Spoilers. The crew faces many obstacles during the mission. An undetected fistula forces them to detour through the heart, where cardiac arrest must be induced to, at best, reduce turbulence that would be strong enough to destroy the Proteus. The crew then faces an unexplained loss of oxygen and must replenish their supply in the lungs. Unexplained because one of the people on board is a Red Saboteur. Grant figures it out before everyone else, so he's more competent than he thinks he is. He has imposter syndrome. They notice rocks that are actually carbon particles from the smoke. Grant finds a surgical laser needed to destroy the clot was damaged during turbulence in the heart, allegedly, as it was not fastened down as it had been before, allegedly, and the safety line snapping loose while the crew was refilling their air supply, lead Grant to suspect, once, as I already intimated, a saboteur is on the mission. A Red Saboteur.
Dun dun dun!
The crew must cannibalize their wireless radio to repair the laser, cutting off all communications and guidance from the outside. Although because the submarine is nuclear-powered, surgeons and technicians outside Benes' body are still able to track their movements via a radioactive tracer, taking the form of adorable little red radar things that are placed outside of Benes' body the whole time.
They're so cute! They look like little babies! But also, like, you're forgetting the most important part of these scenes. They ran out of sugar, damn it!
Oh, yeah. One of the generals overseeing the mission, his nervousness takes the form of him just dumping copious amounts of sugar in his coffee that he just inhales throughout the whole mission. And there's a little scene where he won't crush an ant that's going at the sugar he spilled, and he's like, oh, you're turning into a Hindu, which is an interesting turn of phrase.
Like, surprised that didn't catch on.
Yeah, he works for the Pentagon. Valuing the sanctity of life is not in his job description. Anyways, that means that the generals and the colonels are able to strategize while the sub works their way through. The sub enters the lymphatic system, but the reticular fibers start to interfere. They take the form of seaweed. The crew is then forced to pass through the inner ear, requiring all outside personnel to make no noise to prevent destructive shocks. But while the crew is removing the reticular fibers that look like seaweed, a fallen surgical tool causes the crew to be thrown about, and Peterson is nearly killed by antibodies. But they are able to reboard the submarine in time with her. By the time they reach the clot, however, the crew has only 6 minutes remaining to operate and then exit the body.
So they've only got 6 minutes to save the world?
Yeah, it's 2 minutes to midnight, and that Madonna song is 4 minutes. That Madonna song that only you and I remember.
Yeah, but you gotta say it every time, though. Otherwise, it's not an inside joke that we're forcing on people.
Before the mission, Grant had been briefed that Duvall was the prime suspect as a potential surgical assassin, but as the mission progresses, he instead begins to suspect Michaels. Because Michaels is shifty and nervous, and he has post-traumatic stress because he was buried under rubble during the Blitz, but didn't mention that during the briefing, so he's on the mission anyways. And he's also the only person in the cast that isn't classically handsome.
Well, he was like, I may have been traumatized, but I thought I got over it.
That's essentially how boomers handle trauma, and the silent generation. So much abuse. During the surgery, Dr. Michaels knocks out Owens and takes control of the Proteus because he's the saboteur, while the rest of the crew is outside for the operation. As Duvall finishes removing the clot with his laser, Michaels tries to crash the submarine into the same area of Banes' brain in order to kill him. Grant fires the laser at the ship, causing it to veer away and crash. This also causes Michael to get trapped in the wreckage, with the controls pinning him to the seat, which attracts the attention of white blood cells.
I will say this scene was, despite being old and goofy, like, really upsetting. It's like, my hands! I can't feel my hands! Like, oh no! That's how he was traumatized as a war child!
I don't know how long ago the war was in relation to the scenes in the movie.
About 20 years.
War child!
While Grant saves Owens from the Proteus, Michaels is killed when the white blood cell consumes the ship. The remaining crews quickly swim out to one of Benes' eyes and escape through a tear duct seconds before returning to normal size. And this movie is essentially fuck denouement. We don't know if Benes survives the surgery. We don't get any follow-up over anything else. We roll to credits as everyone is sort of congratulating themselves with inaudible dialogue. End of movie. This is a very tightly edited movie. We'll get to that. So before I go into the development of the film, I thought it would be useful to have an overview on miniature people in fiction up to this point. The idea of tiny people dates back to the earliest traces of mythology and folklore in human civilization. Every culture on Earth has stories of gnomes, fairies, imps, leprechauns, brownies, pixies, sprites, and what have you. Resizing is a common trope in fairy tales in particular, with pronounced examples being Gulliver's Travels and Alice in Wonderland. Yes, Gulliver's Travels is a fairy tale, don't at me. Resizing has no place in hard science fiction since it violates known physical laws, but shrink rays and enlargement gas have been common in the more fantastical corners of the genre since the early 20th century. The earliest example I stumbled across was Edwin Palander's 1902 story, Adventures of a Microman. Mark Twain also took a crack at the concept with 1905's 3,000 Years Among the Microbes. Tarzan encountered the Ant-Men in 1924, and by the time we get to the height of the sci-fi pulp era in the 1930s, size changing was an ever-present motif. In related terms, the first shrinking superhero was Will Eisner's Doll Man, who debuted in 1939. Doll Girl, Tiny Man, the Ray Palmer version of the Atom, Shrinking Violet, Elastigirl, Ant-Man and the Wasp would follow later. The first movie with shrinking people is, unsurprisingly, the work of special effects pioneer Georges Méliès. 1901's The Dwarf and the Giant used trick photography and lens manipulation that was also employed in the 1903 version of Alice in Wonderland. Tiny homunculi show up in 1935's Bride of Frankenstein, and a shrink ray is employed in the 1940 horror film Dr. Cyclops. The most prominent film with a shrink ray prior to Fantastic Voyage is likely 1958's Attack of the Puppet People. Richard Matheson's 1956 novel, The Shrinking Man, was adapted into The Incredible Shrinking Man in 1957. While audiences were mixed about the film retaining Matheson's bleak ending, this is a Twilight Zone guy, the black velvet trick photography was a great success, proving that filmgoers enjoy watching actors in forced perspective interact with giant props. If only there was some kind of crowd-pleasing plot that avoided Matheson's existential horror, then maybe the concept could make some serious money. Like, I don't know if you've read or seen The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Mm-mm. No.
It's about a guy who starts shrinking, and he can't stop, and it completely upends his life, and he's afraid of shrinking down into nothingness, but then he realizes that there are worlds underneath our worlds, and whatever is going to happen to him, he will witness it in some capacity. One of the weirdest chapters in the book that doesn't make it into the movie is that when he is basically like 4 feet tall, he starts a sexual fling with a circus performer, and his wife just has to go along with it.
What the fuck?
Yeah, that was Shrinking Man's a weird book. The Moving Finger in 1965 centers on an astronaut who shrinks to the size of a pinhead and enters a cosmonaut's body to steal intelligent secrets from his brain.
Okay.
Yeah, so it is weirdly parallel to this movie. Fantastic Voyage was conceived by Jerome Bixby and his writing partner Otto Clement. Bixby is best known for penning 4 Star Trek episodes, including Mirror Mirror. He also wrote It's a Good Life, which was adapted into a popular Twilight Zone episode and was used in the movie. Bixby's other films include Curse of the Faceless Man in 1958, It, the Terror from Beyond Space, a kind of proto-alien in 1958 as well, Rampage in 63, The Man from Earth in 2007, which was completed on his deathbed.
I know The Man from Earth, I know that name. That's a crazy movie.
20th Century Fox snapped up the treatment, publicly bragging that they weren't making a B-movie and that Fantastic Voyage would be the most expensive science fiction movie ever made. Director Richard Fleischer and producer Saul David, both trusted company men, were assigned to the project. Fleischer, who was a pre-med student before he became a director, his prior catalog included 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and a bunch of now-forgotten historical and religious epics shot in CinemaScope, so he had experience with effects-driven pictures before this. His later efforts include the 1967 Dr. Dolittle film that flopped so hard that it's frequently argued as being the straw that broke the back of Golden Age Hollywood. He was a survivor, though, directing Tora, 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 Soylent Green, the Neil Diamond remake of The Jazz Singer, Amityville 3D, and Conan the Destroyer in his later years.
Jesus, that's quite the career.
Yeah, he's a journeyman. Fleischer called up his 20,000 Leagues crew to handle the effects for Fantastic Voyage. Harper Goff, a former camouflage expert for the military who became a Disney technician after World War II, designed the Proteus. He met Walt Disney because they were both really into model trains.
That makes sense.
It was a rom-com meet-cute. They both wanted to buy the same train. And they became friends while arguing with each other.
I wonder who got the train.
Probably Disney.
I was going to say, I didn't even question that.
Goff had supervised the construction of the Nautilus in 20,000 Leagues, naturally. His art direction also adorns Main Street USA and the Jungle Cruise in Disneyland. His other art direction credits include Casablanca and Captain Blood, and also Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
That explains a lot.
Yeah. The Proteus was 42 feet long and contained all of the interior sets used in the film. Individual sections could be pulled out to make room for camera and lighting equipment. A tiny Proteus was also built for the scenes where the ship interacted with abstract representations of the human body. There was also a 5-foot model that was used for scenes where the heart and brain were involved. An 18-inch Proteus was used for the bit where an arterial wall was breached. And there was also a Proteus only a few inches in length that was crafted for the syringe bit. However, one of those models was left by a window and carried off by a crow.
That's amazing. I can love crows.
The plasma effects were handled by chief operator Ernest Laszlo, who employed a multicolored turning light strategically placed outside of translucent spaces in order to, like, have spacey red and blue blood cells.
Those sequences were the most pleasing ones that made me just want to take a nap.
Yeah, that's why this movie's very soothing, even though it's incredibly tense. The scenes of crew members swimming outside of the sub were not shot in water tanks, which I assumed. Instead, actors were suspended from wires, and the footage was shot at a faster frame rate in order to imply resistance. The wires were weakened with acid to make them less reflective to the cameras. Crew members expressed concern, but there were no accidents.
Well, that's like a first, but cool.
Yeah, I was waiting for the part where somebody got horribly mangled, and yeah, it didn't happen. Everyone was very lucky. For the scene where the actors frantically remove antibodies from Raquel Welch, Fleischer instructed the men to touch her wherever they wanted.
That sounds right for the time.
Not wishing to make Welch feel unviolated, everyone pointedly avoided her chest and butt.
Hooray!
When Fleischer pointed out that this unintentionally created a sort of burlesque dance sequence, cast members all started reaching for Welch's boobs at once. At that point, Fleischer realized that he would have to choreograph who removed what from where.
That was a roller coaster of a story.
Fantastic Voyage had a $5 million budget that ballooned to $6 million, largely because effect shots were on the cutting edge of film technology at the time and had to be figured out by trial and error. The sets cost $3 million, and test footage ate up another million. Another thing is that Fantastic Voyage is carefully edited so that the miniaturization does not last for longer than 1 hour. This movie takes place in real time, essentially, once they get shrunken down.
Which I appreciate. Like, I was always one of those kids that if the characters are underwater holding their breath, I always held my breath to see if I could. So I'm like, yeah, this is good. This is how you make movies.
Yeah, there's always gonna be at least one person in the crowd with a stopwatch being like, okay, it's 1 hour. Take that, nerd. Fantastic Voyage won't violate that suspension of disbelief, but lots of other things. We'll get to those. But first, we're gonna talk about the cast for a bit. Our lead is Stephen Boyd as Grant, the imposter syndrome man. He doesn't know how to put a band-aid on his finger.
He's like the epitome of somebody getting woken up in the middle of a REM cycle. He's just off his game for like half the movie.
That's the thing. They pull him out of his bed in the middle of the night and he's still putting on his suit in the car.
Perfect hair, though.
Oh yeah, his hair is wonderful. Boyd became a star after his turn in Ben-Hur, spending most of the 60s filming epic movies all over the world. He found working on a Hollywood set for Fantastic Voyage to be an incredibly refreshing change of pace. Most of Boyd's colleagues found him very charming and witty. He is actually Irish. He has a brogue in his natural speaking voice.
Aw, that would have been awesome.
That does explain why he sounds so forcibly relaxed and labored if it isn't a natural accent for him.
He lifted the morale of many a long day on set with dry jokes delivered in that Irish brogue, as I already mentioned. Raquel Welch became infatuated with Boyd and essentially threw herself at him, but he gently turned down every single one of her advances. Boyd had a habit of shyly declining amorous come-ons from his co-stars that seemed to happen in every movie he was involved with. This led me to assume, okay, when are you going to tell me that he was gay?
That's what I've been waiting for.
However, he eventually married his assistant, Elizabeth Mills, in 1974. They had known each other for over 20 years at that point, so I guess he was finally comfortable around her.
Aww, that's so sweet. He was in love.
Unfortunately, he died soon after. He was only 45.
What happened to him?
I'm not sure exactly. Some heart condition that was never diagnosed.
Aww, that's so sad. Oh.
My wife's going through all the emotions.
Roller coaster!
I mean, this movie is very short and punchy and to the point, so no character gets to be more than an archetype, but Boyd is the nervous dude who rises to the occasion. He is the hero who is forced into the situation, and he fills that role about as well as anyone could. And he has that very classical 1960s movie star jawline, including the chin dimple.
That dude's chin dimple you could get lost in.
And the way this movie is lit, like every Caucasian person, so every character in this movie, is lit to be orange, and Boyd has these piercing blue Irish eyes. I mean, Pleasance also has blue eyes, but he's not as pretty. Alright, then we have Raquel Welch as Cora. Welch had bit parts in film and TV, most prominently in the Elvis movie Roustabout. She was consciously marketing herself as a Marilyn Monroe or Elizabeth Taylor-styled sex symbol up to this point. In fact, she was being considered as a Bond girl in Thunderball when Saul David scooped her up for Fox. He tried to pressure her into adopting the stage name Debbie, but she insisted on keeping Raquel.
I'd say that's a solid move.
Debbie Welch.
She did, however, retain her ex-husband's surname because she felt that her maiden name of Tejada would limit her career options.
Also probably correct.
Welch would shoot 1 million years BC a few months after Fantastic Voyage and would vault to international sex symbol status immediately afterwards. Cave girl bikini's gonna do that for you.
I do think that whoever was doing her makeup for this movie deserves some praise. Her eyeliner and her eye makeup was just so fantastic.
Like I said, none of the characters really get too many moments to shine, but Welch gets a fun little moment where she's sort of flirting with Boyd's character while playing with the laser and being like, yeah, I know how to use this laser, so keep your hands where they belong. That's like the one moment of hoxie and badinage we have in this film.
I also think she did some pretty decent acting when she's supposedly being like strangled to death by the kelp.
Considering that four dudes were groping her, she's an awfully good sport.
Her eyes were screaming.
Yeah. Like I said, the eye makeup. Like, it obviously, you know, her acting too, but the makeup, the way it emphasized her eyes and when she has the helmet on and that's all you can see, like, that was well done. That was a pretty quality moment in an otherwise really cheesy movie.
Yeah, next we have Edmund O'Brien as General Alan Carter. He had been working since Hunchback of Notre Dame in 1939, and he had starred in White Heat, 1984, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and won an Oscar for Barefoot Contessa. Before that, got a nod for 7 Days in May. So he was better than this.
Was this Mustache General or Coffee General?
Mustache General.
Okay.
By the way, he was Winston in 1984. Then we have Donald Pleasence as Dr. Michaels, maybe one of the only actors that somebody born after 1980 would immediately recognize in this movie, besides maybe Welch. He was also in 1984. Pleasence is a character actor. He's basically playing a variation of the weaselly stuck-up archetype that he usually does. Not too different from Dr. Loomis, which is what most people are going to know him for.
He's a bit less manic than Loomis in this and does not shoot anyone 6 times.
Not through a lack of trying, though. All I had was that pipe.
He did try to run everyone over with a submarine, so that's pretty badass.
And also, this is probably the classiest movie that Pleasence was ever in.
God.
Despite his affects, like, he's in garbage.
Does that make you sad? It makes me sad.
Like, he's on multiple episodes of Mystery Science Theater 3000, isn't he?
Probably.
All right, then we have Arthur O'Connell as Colonel Donald Reed. He's also a character actor who appeared in everything from Citizen Kane to Gidget. And he also had Oscar nominations for Picnic and Anatomy of a Murder. I believe he was Sugar Guy.
Ah, Sugar General.
Well, apparently he's a colonel.
Whatever.
Unless I've mixed up their names.
Colonel Diabetes.
Yeah. Then there's William Redfield as Captain Bill Owens. Arthur Kennedy as Dr. Peter Duvall. And I wanted to mention that Dr. Jan Benes, probably the most thankless role in this movie, was played by Jean Delval.
He just gets to lay on an operating table the whole film and just be...
If I had to be shirtless, like, that long with people doing close-ups of weird parts of my body, though, like, he deserves a shout-out.
Yeah. They also drew on his head with a blue Sharpie.
He looked like they were getting ready to turn him into a Hellraiser character.
Like, this wasn't, you know, an incidental quick look at his body and then moving on.
Yeah, and he was a middle-aged man who wasn't in great shape. He's clearly not self-conscious about himself if he set himself up for this.
Surrounded by a room full of people who are just staring at him.
The music for this film was composed by Leonard Rosenman. His credits besides this include East of Eden, Rebel Without a Cause, Star Trek IV, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, Barry Lyndon, and the animated Lord of the Rings, the aforementioned Neil Diamond remake of The Jazz Singer, and RoboCop 2.
What the fuck?
Also so something of a journeyman.
If you present him with a project, he'll probably come up with an idea for it.
You know what? Composers need to pay their damn rent, and it is hard to make a living as a composer. If I had that skill set and somebody's like, hey, can you come up with something for RoboCop 2? I would find a way. Rosenman deliberately withheld music until they entered the body. This is something I knew to look out for. I don't think I would have noticed that unless it was pointed out to me beforehand, but it is done very effectively, and it does raise the tension where you have the music inside the body, but every time they cut outside the body, it is stone silence, and it does create a nice dichotomy between the relatively grounded realism of the scooter-filled military base and then psychedelic plasma lights.
I did immediately immediately, like, notice that anytime they're in outside the body land, this movie's, like, really taking itself seriously. Like, this is a military drama. And then it's just fantastic voyage time.
P pointed out that the music inside is very Star Trek. It's not shocking that he has Star Trek on his resume. Sylvan pointed out that the bassoon goes hard. And there is a lot of fugue-like composition going on. There's lots of tension between the instruments. There's very little harmony. It doesn't quite get this Karl Heinz Stockhausen territory, but I would say that there's a lot of Stravinsky in there. The one moment where we do get music outside of the body is when everybody is triumphantly grown back to size. And, yeah, we get the end credits.
End of movie.
And the film does use atonality and sound effects for the opening credits, which I think was nicely done, and I think it evinces Forbidden Planet, which also has a magnificent score that I pointed out on the Forbidden Planet episode. Fox made the special effects a focal point in Fantastic Voyage's marketing, even springing for an extensive profile in Life magazine. Reviews were largely positive, with praise usually lavished on the visuals. Camp, then a fresh buzzword due to the Batman TV show, was often used in reviews while describing the scientifically inaccurate premise of it. Fantastic Voyage made $8.8 million in its initial box office release, which was a minor loss. This was, however, more than made up for by TV broadcasts and re-releases. So overall, Fox considered it a success. It won Oscars for art direction and color. This is during a period where they were still separating color and black and white in the art direction category. It won an Oscar for its special effects. It was nominated for its cinematography, losing to A Man for All Seasons. It was nominated for its film editing, losing the Grand Prix. And it was nominated for sound editing, also losing the Grand Prix. At this point, I should talk about the movie's novelization. Bantam Books approached Isaac Asimov to write a novelization of the film.
Really swinging for the fences there, huh?
Asimov initially declined because he felt movie novelizations were beneath him. He was among the most foremost science fiction writers of that time, if not the foremost. And yeah, movie novelizations were, they're not respected. He was eventually persuaded to sign on when Bantam agreed to pay him more, give him residual checks for it, and also publish a hardback edition. Asimov was like, a writer of my stature deserves a hardback release, even if it's just a crappy movie novelization.
He drove up to my house with a dump truck full of money.
Asimov didn't like the scientifically impossible notion of shrink rays, but what really bothered him about Fantastic Voyage is that the Proteus remains inside Dr. Benes at the end of the story. He resolves that in the adaptation. The sub leaves the tear duct with the crew.
Well, it got eaten by the white blood cells.
Just like in real life.
What I'm saying is they didn't leave it behind. It got all destroyed.
Apparently that was too much for Asimov. Because of production delays, Asimov's novel came out 6 months before the movie, leading many to understandably assume that the film was adapted from the book and not the other way around. Once again, Asimov was way too big to be doing movie novelizations. This is an understandable mistake to make. Fantastic Voyage was adapted into a Saturday morning cartoon produced by Filmation and aired on ABC from 1968 to 1969. There were 17 episodes, all of them involving them shrinking down into a submarine and going somewhere for some reason.
I mean,
I'm for it. Absolutely for it.
I'm not surprised.
I mean, this was a couple of years before Filmation did the Star Trek cartoon, and yeah, there's definitely a similar vibe going on, and a number of similar voice actors. Gold Key published a 2-issue comic book adaptation of the film. According to Wikipedia, it was drawn by Wally Wood, but then I looked at some of the artwork and I thought it was a little too stiff for him. And yeah, it's mostly Dan Adkins with largely anonymous inker, and Wally Wood inked a couple of pages. If you're familiar with comic book art, you'll know that Wood's very lush brushwork kind of overwhelms any penciler he works with, no matter how distinct they are, so you can recognize him right away. Larry Siegel and Mort Drucker lampooned the film with Fantastic Voyage in Mad Magazine number 110, published in 1967.
That'll show him.
I'm sure it was a playful riff. A Fantastic Voyage video game was produced for the Atari 2600 in 1982. I looked at footage and on YouTube, and it does not look very good. Kevin J. Anderson wrote Fantastic Voyage Microcosm in 2001, which focuses on the Proteus crew investigating the mysterious corpse of an alien in a crashed UFO. It delves into then-current concepts of nanotechnology. And finally, the 1987 Joe Dante comedy Innerspace is an unofficial remake of Fantastic Voyage, leaning into the dopey cliches and unintentional humor of the original. From what I read, the screenwriter conceived of Innerspace as a Fantastic Voyage knockoff and wrote it as a serious drama, but when it was shopped to Dante, he was like, this is just a ripoff of Fantastic Voyage, I'm not directing this unless you make it funny. And then we get into the many, many attempts at a sequel or a remake. Isaac Asimov was approached about writing a sequel in 1984, which would have focused on a shrink-tech arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union. Asimov hated this idea. So Philip Jose Farmer was brought in to write the screenplay, while Asimov was given free rein to write a sequel in name only that has a plot that he came up with on his own. Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain, centers on a completely new cast of Soviet characters undergoing a similar mission to the film plot.
Destination Brain.
That sounds like an X-Men episode from our childhood.
The sequel was published in 1987. Despite Asimov endorsing Farmer's screenplay, the project was never greenlit. James Cameron flirted with the idea of remaking Fantastic Voyage after Titanic, but he shifted focus to developing Avatar. Fox hired Roland Emmerich to direct Cameron's screenplay, but Emmerich didn't like the script at all and moved on to 2012 after the writer's strike in 2007 stalled out the development of the remake. Paul Greengrass and Sean Levy both got involved in a 2010 remake attempt produced by Cameron, but this didn't work out either. However, it's not a real story about Hollywood development hell until Guillermo del Toro comes in. He was attached to a Fantastic Voyage remake in 2016 alongside writer David S. Goyer. I'm not a Goyer fan. I'm pretty happy this didn't happen. Del Toro abandoned it to make The Shape of Water instead. And then after The Shape of Water won Best Picture at the Oscars, he used that leverage to complete his dream project of a stop-motion animated Pinocchio movie. A Fantastic Voyage remake is still in pre-production as of this recording.
It's actually pretty impressive that we haven't gotten something yet.
Well, we got like 500 riffs.
Yeah, I guess that kind of makes... I mean, I'm sure studios are like, we can't make a serious remake of this. There's too many parodies.
And I emphasize in that introduction, that is a partial list of parodies. I had to pare that down.
Yeah, every cartoon of our childhood, I think, did it at least once. To the point where when Mr. Glorioso put this on in science class, I was like, oh, there's a first one. That makes sense.
I'm guessing a lot of people who stumble across this have that sensation. But that brings us to themes. The first thing I wrote down was Cold War paranoia.
Fuck the communists.
As we often touch upon in this podcast, seemingly every science fiction movie to come out of Hollywood in the 50s is secretly, or not so secretly, about the Cold War. This mindset definitely continued into the 60s and 70s, coloring everything from the utopianism of Star Trek to the pessimism of Planet of the Apes. Fantastic Voyage, with its Soviet spy antagonist, is certainly no exception. Fantastic Voyage was conceived and executed as a simple, uncomplicated rah-rah crowd pleaser. Despite the Vietnam quagmire, it was still a safe bet to use the Reds as bad guys in a movie like this that was attempting to do populist appeal, which I feel is just revealing in and of itself of the culture of the time. The Cold War was a culture war as well as a series of proxy wars. The CIA funded exhibitions for abstract expressionist Jackson Pollock, thinking that the vague creative passion of his work was a strong counter to the socialist realism movement. The Pentagon was also behind writers' workshops that stressed how gauche it was to comment directly on societal inequity. This is where the phrase "show, don't tell" was coined. The government also sponsored international tours for Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Dave Brubeck solely because they felt jazz could be a friendly face for anti-communism. Brubeck had mixed feelings when he was later informed about this. Fantastic Voyage wasn't, at least to my knowledge, directly funded by the Pentagon, although plenty of films before and since have been. Still, it embodies many of the sentiments being pushed by the Defense Department at the time, the most prominent being science as a tool to defeat the Soviet Union. This was a big thing amongst weapons developers settled in Orange County, where they were attempting to, in a political sense, marry evangelical Christianity to laissez-faire right-wing libertarianism and have those things coexist even though they don't make sense together. And yeah, massive defense spending is part of that. One Orange County weapons developer published a book about his feelings where he pointed out that so many high schools celebrate athletics, but even though you could name the most talented basketball player at any school, you don't know who the top science student is, and that's a shame because we need to beat the Reds. And you know, he kind of had me until he got to the last bit. America was knee-deep in the space race in 1966. The film in its little prologue is like, we're gonna be on the moon soon. And turns out that they were right about that. Both then
so
and...
that's one thing.
Both then and now, the space race was sold to the public as a bold, altruistic quest for knowledge and an effort to defeat the Soviets on a purely intellectual and philosophical level. Naturally, the reality is a little less pure-hearted than this. The United States wanted to build more effective rockets, basically. They wanted to be able to fire them across vast distances, both reliably and accurately. They brought in Nazi engineers to do this. They even put up with the audacity of black women who were good at math to do this. Putting a man on the moon was an excellent feel-good story to sell this project with. And I'm not saying that the space race didn't accomplish good and valuable things. It very much did that, and overall, I am very pro-NASA and pro-scientific inquiry. At the same time, all of those positive byproducts occurred because of a bunch of weapons contractors in Orange County lobbied Congress into giving them a cushy job thinking up a more efficient way to bathe the world in nuclear hellfire. And call me naive, but I think we can explore the frontiers of human knowledge without getting that element involved.
Exploration, yay!
Yeah, and that's what I think of whenever I encounter, like, all that nostalgic Kennedy-era optimism. It's all colored behind, we gotta nuke the Reds better than they can nuke us.
Yep.
And yeah, getting back to that story about how we don't know who the best science student in every high school is, I don't think that's something that we entirely have to worry about in terms of weapons, because if you take even a cursory look at the history of America, once rockets became a thing, we were going to have more of them and the biggest version of them than anyone else right away. Like, that's our vibe. The next theme I wrote down was, what's the appeal of shrinking movies? Because I didn't want to end on the nuclear hellfire note.
Yeah, it's a downer.
By nature, shrinking movies force the audience to look at the world around them from another perspective. Just about every retrospective I've read on the history of shrinking movies has touched upon this at least a little bit. They also point out, as I'm about to, that most of those Fantastic Voyage parodies are for kid shows. And I think that's not only because the premise is a little over the top and silly for most adult fare, but also just, like, it's easy for kids to connect to shrinking movies like that because it takes a bunch of adults and forces them into scenarios where they're looking up at things and they're more powerless than they used to be, and in a way, by proxy, they're experiencing the world in a way that small children often do. And I think that kids, at least on a subconscious level, are likely to relate to that, and maybe that's why they think it's neat.
Also, it's neat.
Yes, that was my next point. These films provide ample space for interesting, memorable, and amusing imagery. An early pop culture memory from my childhood is the Cheerio scene from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, just because that scene looks freaking cool.
Yeah, no, I'm on board with that. Also, I was genuinely worried that those kids were gonna get eaten.
Yeah, there's tension in that. Although, the death of the aunt.
Aww. Auntie. My childhood, there were definitely hundreds of hours spent playing one of the Magic School Bus games where you just explore the human body miniaturized and just go from place to place doing fun little activities. I could just sit at a computer for an entire day just playing that game.
Yeah, we didn't read much Magic School Bus, and when I was in elementary school, we just did the one on the human body, so I assumed that that was the only thing the Magic School Bus ever did. It was yeah. Like, no, they go to, like, caves and explain what a stalagmite is. They do that, too. All right, well, that's everything I had written down. Is there anything that anyone would like to comment on about Fantastic Voyage before we close things out?
So I think that in addition to the makeup, I think the hair was awesome in this movie.
Yeah, we knew that the hair was very carefully constructed. When the guy's getting off the plane, their hair didn't move.
Not even a bit. And then,
I mean, I don't think they were getting off an actual plane that was actually landing, but still.
And then Cora's, like, extra back wig, that was very impressive. I don't know what you guys want to call that, but...
Getting back to watching Fantastic Voyage in science class as a middle schooler, Mr. Glorioso, during the scene where Raquel Welch was stripping down to her swim skivvies, he picked up a vanilla envelope and blocked the screen with it.
That's so cute because you see nothing.
Yeah, you don't. In fact, her suit is zipped down a little bit so you can see like a hint of cleavage, just enough for the Hays Code to get away with, but maybe the male actors acting in solidarity also zipped down to an equal length.
Oh yeah, 100% you could see some chest for them. That was pretty cute.
Yeah, even Pleasance, he got in on it.
Speaking of Pleasance, my final thought on the movie is honorary horror mention on the scene where Donald Pleasance gets eaten by a white blood cell or whatever that's supposed to be. That was fucked up.
Very The Blob, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like the most emotive actor in the movie, and he does not want to die, even though his sabotages all throughout the movie...
Yeah, that's treason. He wasn't going to live for much longer.
But like, his sabotages, he was going to die with everyone else every step of the way.
Yeah, he's very loyal to Mother Russia. However, Hand Guy's the best actor in this movie.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody. Join us next time.